The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, every day we are confronted with more imagery of starving, injured and dying children in Gaza. And one of the things that sticks in my mind is about three or four days ago, Associated Press had a headline, "The latest child to die in Gaza weighed less than the weight she was when she was born." And that's what's going on there. We're often left helpless. We're unsure what we can do after seeing these images. And that feeling is called moral injury. We'll talk about moral injury in a few moments' time. But first we go to Greg Carlstrom, Middle East correspondent with The Economist, to talk about what's actually going on in Gaza at the moment. Greg, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Now, let's talk about what the Israelis say they're doing in terms of pausing and allowing aid to go in, how much aid is going in, and what the Israelis are sometimes doing when that aid is being sought by the Palestinians. 70 people killed yesterday while looking for aid.
The Israelis have said that they are implementing what they call a tactical pause in parts of Gaza. So there are three population centers around the strip where the Israeli army says it is suspending operations, military operations, for 10 hours a day. In theory, that should allow people to collect food more safely. The problem is, first of all, there's still not enough food going into Gaza. There have been about 270 trucks allowed to enter the territory over the past 4 days. The UN says you need about 500 to 600 trucks per day right now because of how dire the situation is, how great the demand is for food. So nowhere near what is needed. And then the second issue is distributing that aid. It's not just a question of the UN getting permission from Israel to bring it into Gaza. The UN also has to bring that food to people who need it, and very often trying to get across Gaza is difficult. It has to be coordinated with the Israeli army, which routinely denies requests from the UN and other aid groups to organize convoys to move aid around Gaza.
And when you're moving aid, if you send a single truck with aid to a particular community, it will often be stopped en route by people who are desperate for some sort of nutrition, and it won't get through. Literally, it'll be looted, and you can understand that. So the only way, as the UN suggests, is to flood the zone with so much food that there's no point in looting. There's no point in, you know, your desperation will not be particularly rewarded any better than patiently waiting for the proper distribution of that food.
And we've seen that happen at earlier points in the war. If you think back to the ceasefire that was in effect for 6 weeks at the beginning of this year, we did see 400, 500 trucks a day going into Gaza. Obviously, there was no fighting at that time, so it was easier to move the aid around the territory. It got to people who needed it, and also the prices of food on the gray market. Some of this aid, of course, is being resold by traders on the gray market or the black market in Gaza. But the prices came down significantly, almost to pre-war levels during the ceasefire. So there is a way to do this. There is a way to deliver enough aid that will prevent these kinds of chaotic incidents that you mentioned. But obviously, we're far from that now.
On that gray market, I heard the UN say yesterday that a kilo of sugar would cost $100 US. Kilo of sugar on the grey market. So obviously a lot more needs to be done. By the way, that charge of looting by Hamas of aid trucks, which has been denied by everybody, some Israelis saying it's not happening, but also USAID, what's left of it, also making the same contention.
There's no evidence that it's happening on a systemic level. I mean, Israel has 24/7 surveillance intelligence gathering in Gaza. I think if there was a massive Hamas operation to divert aid, whether to feed its own fighters or as a source of revenue, I think Israel would be able to point to some evidence of it. Now, it stands to reason that some fraction of the food entering Gaza obviously has found its way into the hands of Hamas. They've been able to feed their fighters for the past 2 years. So obviously, some portion of aid winds up with them. But is it happening on an enormous scale? As Israel alleges, Hamas making hundreds of millions of dollars a year from reselling looted aid. Again, there's no proof of that. And I think very often when we see these scenes of people mobbing the trucks that are going into Gaza, it's not Hamas doing it. It's, as you said before, it's ordinary people doing it who are just desperate for any source of food.
Now, those tactical pauses that Israel announced to allow limited aid to get through, there's no doubt that these tactical pauses were forced on Israel by the weight of public opinion, ordinary people, but also governments and also even Jewish organizations, for example, in the United Kingdom and in the United States, critical of what the Israeli government is doing and speaking out as Jewish people. Because they're aware of the anti-Semitic rise that is occurring because of the actions of the Israeli government.
It is. I think it is because of that pressure. I mean, I think we have seen over the past couple of weeks this issue of starvation in Gaza sort of make it into mainstream media, even right-wing newspapers in the UK, for example, that have had on their front covers in recent days images of starving children in Gaza. That's not something that we've seen much of over the past 2 years. And it's even an issue that has penetrated the Israeli consciousness, I would say. If you watch the main evening news broadcasts in Israel over the past couple of weeks, there has been some discussion of starvation in Gaza. It's not being dismissed out of hand as it was at other points in the war when Israel was throttling the amount of aid that was going in and denied that anyone was hungry in Gaza. Now it's even on mainstream news broadcasts in Israel, and it's something that has provoked not just international criticism, but some measure of domestic criticism as well.
Now, the impact of France, first of all, President Macron said in September at the General Assembly, they will recognize a Palestinian state. Then the UK, Sir Keir Starmer, rode in with his potential recognition of a Palestinian state unless Israel does certain things. And that was echoed by Mark Carney of Canada. That kind of threat, we'll recognize Palestine unless. It's a bit Mickey Mouse, to be quite honest.
That's a good way to describe it. I mean, I think it's interesting, first of all, the different demands that everyone is making. Starmer's demands aimed squarely at Israel, trying to change Israeli behavior. Mark Carney, in his statement overnight, made demands of the Palestinian Authority. He said Canada will recognize Palestine in September if Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, holds new elections next year, something that he hasn't done in two decades, and if he excludes Hamas from running in those elections and participating in governance. So Carney trying to use this as a source of pressure on the Palestinians. But I think for all three of these leaders, the question is really, well, okay, what next? Recognition of Palestine is a symbolic step. It's a powerful symbolic step, but it's only a symbolic step. So is that going to translate into policy change, meaningful pressure on the Israeli government to try to end the occupation and create a Palestinian state? Or is this going to be a symbolic measure that some Western countries enact to avoid having to take those more sort of substantive punitive measures against Israel?
And Carney, for his pains, has had an admonishment from President Trump saying this could make a trade deal very difficult. So he's using trade, as he's using it with Brazil and India, he's using trade as a weapon for his political goals. Anyway, Greg, thank you very much for joining us with that analysis of the latest from Gaza. But we talked about our own observation on our screens every night, and it looks like Trump only got his information not from his intelligence people, but from looking at pictures on television. That's what he said anyway, as to what's going on. But we're looking at those pictures, and we are experiencing what is termed moral injury. Brendan Kelly, Professor of Psychiatry at Trinity College in Dublin, is with me now. Brendan, good morning. What is that moral injury? How do you define it?
So moral injury is the distress we feel when we cannot act in accordance with our values. So it's when we see something, we want to act about it because our ethical values, our moral values, our human values, our emotions, our thoughts all tell us we should do something. But for some reason, we can't. So it's this, what we would call cognitive dissonance, this chasm between what we're thinking, what we believe about ourselves, and then what we can do or cannot do.
Now, what are the coping strategies? We feel this, and all the time, the people will text this program, they will, you know, text each other and social media each other, expressing outrage. But what more can you do?
Well, what some people do is they withdraw completely. They can't cope with it. They turn off the news. They close their eyes. They close their ears. They avoid this. We'll do anything to avoid this kind of dissonance, this kind of moral injury or moral harm. That is not a good strategy. That is a bad strategy. Looking away is not the answer to this. The first thing is to acknowledge this is happening, to know that we're feeling these feelings, to let them happen. And maybe to limit it to a certain extent, limit the media exposure a little bit. That doesn't mean turning away all the time. It means turning away some of the time and realizing you can't carry the weight of the world on your individual shoulders all day and all night. But then the best solution is to act, to do something, no matter how small. The intention to act is important, and so is the action, no matter how limited it might be. And that is the way to overcome moral injury.
So what kind of action might someone take? I mean, you can obviously make a donation to UNICEF or to any of the charities working in Gaza or wherever else is affronting you. But what else might you do?
Okay, so the donation is incredibly important. And doing that shaped by logic and reason is more important than doing it shaped by emotion. So you recognize the emotion, you decide to do something, and then you put your thinking hat on. You donate to an organization that is reputable, you donate in a tax-efficient way, you optimize that, put a bit of thought into it, as well as a bit of emotion. The second thing is, you know, when we're seeking to resolve conflict, we need to think about this in a psychologically sophisticated way. Other people have moral injury too. So, and what I'm talking about here, Pat, is in conflicts, aggressor nations always have within them people who are uneasy about what is happening. This might manifest as an anti-war movement in an aggressor country, but there's a lot of the population, even people in the military, unhappy with what they're doing themselves. So there are two kinds of moral injury. It's when you're actually doing something that doesn't accord with your values, and then when you're watching something or aware of something that doesn't accord. Now, most of us are in the second category, but many soldiers, many combatants are in the first category. They might have signed up to join the army, but now they find themselves doing things they're very unhappy with.
Now, we see regularly protests of various kinds and lots of Palestinian flags being waved. And sometimes there's a problem for people who will have a dichotomy. They think, I really despise what Hamas orchestrated on October the 7th. I mean, I understand their quest for statehood. I understand all the history and what happened with the Balfour Declaration and the divvying up of land in the Middle East. I understand all of that, but I don't like what Hamas did. And equally, I don't like what Israel is doing at the moment. So they're reluctant maybe to join a protest for fear they'll be seen as Hamas sympathizers.
So look, all conflicts are complex. If we're talking about this one, if we're talking about Ukraine, no matter where we're talking about. And the fact that it's complicated and there is a risk of misinterpretation should not stop us acting in what we believe to be the best way. So, for example, a protest is a very blunt thing. It is either a sort of a yes, no, you support or you don't. But most people's positions are more sophisticated. Most people understand that as well. And it's important when part of a crowd not to necessarily move to a very binary position, but to make your point clearly and to be there. You know, we underestimate the value of bearing witness, of standing in solidarity, of being together and, you know, creating these ripples that will affect other people, both those involved and those like us who might be thinking
now,
about
the normal them. Way things work in forming policy are through the ballot box. And we've had our election. We won't get another chance for a little while. But putting pressure on our politicians to behave in a particular way, obviously, public pressure is working at the moment on Israel. They're feeling it from many, many quarters. I forget how many nations on earth 140, I think, are now in favour of, more than 140, are in favour of Palestinian statehood. But in terms of how we can pressure our own politicians, or does that make any difference?
So pressuring politicians makes a huge difference. Pressuring them locally, pressuring them nationally about any conflict, this or any conflict. And individual communications from constituents to politicians are a huge way of exerting pressure, starting with the line.
But is that only to make us feel good? Or, I mean, they may say, well, sure, what can I do?
No, it's not.
I'm only
just
here representing rural this or rural that.
And it's not just to make us feel good. We've seen the Irish government take quite outspoken positions in a number of conflicts in recent years. So when you email that politician or write them a letter indicating you live in their constituency, you vote for them or will consider doing so, politicians are exquisitely sensitive to local emails that say, I am considering voting for you or not. That is the way to exert pressure, and it might feel like it goes unnoticed, but it absolutely doesn't, not by the politicians. Irish politics are very local, and this can be leveraged to make them take positions on international issues.
Now, what about the risk of us becoming polarized in our own minds by what we're seeing? In other words, in spite of your best attempts not to be totally anti-Semitic or even anti-Israel, because there are anti-war movements, as you pointed out, there are protests on the street, there are people, including former Prime Minister Olmert, saying, you know, this is the wrong, these are concentration camps they're trying to build in Gaza, this is unconscionable, all of that. But you want to try and make sure that you don't slip into an attitude that you wouldn't really be proud of.
Yeah, so this is when we need to step back and see the difference between what political leaders decide to do and what people in their countries decide to do. And there's often a bit of wiggle room, a bit of a lag there. And we see this also in other conflicts. We see this particularly in Russia, for example, and Ukraine, where the political leadership is making decisions that aren't necessarily supported by the majority of population, but there isn't enough protest to change them. So by recognising the common humanity of the majority of the population on both sides of a conflict, we can start to identify with the complexity of these situations. I mean, the island of Ireland is no stranger to conflict, and we all know that there often is a chasm between political leadership and what they decide versus what happens on the ground, what people feel, what people would like to see happen on both sides. That takes a good while to catch up. So, I mean, I think by focusing on the common humanity and seeing the suffering on all sides, because nobody wins, literally nobody wins in these protracted conflicts on either side.
Professor Brendan Kelly, thank you very much for joining us and exploring the feeling many of us are having of moral injury looking at those images on television.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.